Welcome to this episode of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, in which we realize that old habits die hard, and the American establishment's unquestioning support for Israel is a very old habit indeed. As Israel's government drifted farther and farther to the right, culminating in a genocidal push into Gaza, President Biden, standard-bearer of the old establishment, seems destined to be the very last Democrat to see the need for a change. Sources today include The Daily Show, Al Jazeera English, The Humanist Report, Democracy Now!, Deconstructed, and The Majority Report, with additional members-only clips from Doomed and Democracy Now!
The war in Gaza is now 6 months old. I think time for a wellness check. But as the war has grinded on, justice is beginning to seem more like cruelty. But not to worry. America, the shining city on a hill, is on the case with our universal values.
In the great battle for freedom, between a rules-based order and one governed by brute force, in this battle, we need to be clear-eyed.
And just to clarify, we are the freedom folks. We're the rules people. We're not the brute force ones. I think we all know who the brute force ones are. In this case, Vladimir. And know that America will call you out when you violate the basic tenets of humanity.
Weaponizing food, using it as a tool, as a weapon in its war against Ukraine, it's unconscionable. Should not happen.
It's unconscionable. Weaponizing food in Ukraine is not kosher, nor halal. Sorry if I'm both sidesing this. Speaking of which, there is a literal famine in Gaza caused by the war. I assume America will also consider this unconscionable.
Absolutely, we're concerned about that. No question about it.
Well, you can't spell unconscionable without concern, or at least part of it, the C-O-N part. You can reuse the C-O-N. You get the point. How about the free press? Ordinarily, we are strongly in favor of free press.
We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists.
You hear that, Russia? We condemn, in no uncertain terms, any repression of a free press. I think you all know what's coming next. More journalists have been killed in Gaza in 6 months than anywhere else in the world. And a new Israeli law says they can ban media outlets they consider a threat.
So as it relates to Al Jazeera specifically, we've seen the reports. If it is true, a move like this is concerning.
Don't know what we're concerned again. How about if it's true, we condemn it? And by the way, is it true? Like, it feels like you could probably just call someone and be like, is this true? And if they're like, yeah, it's true, you could be like, that's concerning. Not condemning, but concerning. Well, you know what? Perhaps these are just peripheral issues. What about the bedrock rule of international law? No taking land by force. When Russia does it, we're pretty clear.
The entire world has a stake in making sure that no nation, no aggressor, is allowed to take a neighbor's territory by force. The American people will never waver in our commitment to those values.
Ish. See, this is where Israel's actions get interesting. Because you might say Israel's war is different than Ukraine's. Israel's responding to an attack and a hostage crisis. But in the midst of that, they pulled a little something in the West Bank on March 22nd that might be notable.
As the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made his latest visit to Israel, the Israeli government announced that it was declaring state land, nearly 2,000 acres of land, in the occupied West Bank.
This latest Israeli appropriation is the largest land transfer since the Oslo Accords were signed in 1993.
1993, and that's not even Gaza, that's the West Bank. So you can't say it has anything to do with defending yourself against Hamas. Let's see if America upholds its rule against taking land.
I haven't seen the specifics of this, but anyone taking steps that makes things more difficult, more challenging this time, is something that we have a problem with.
You don't know about it. They did it the day you visited. Why do we tiptoe around on eggshells? They slap America in the face and our response is, well, if anyone slapped us in the face, it'd be concerning, that's for sure. I mean, raising a hand to a delicate body part of the face. If true, the verbal gymnastics that the American government must undertake so as not to offend the delicate sensibilities of a country we provide most of the weapons for is... Yeah! Every time America tells the world that there's something we won't allow, Israel seems to say, challenge accepted. Are they willfully trying to provoke us? Or perhaps they're just reading our principles from right to left. It's over. It's really, to be honest, it's kind of a bar mitzvah joke, but that's it. Over 30,000 have died in Gaza since the war started. Some of them Hamas soldiers, 13,000 of them children. Our response.
Since the early hours, we've been urging our Israeli counterparts to act with as much precision as they can in their targeting. Our constant efforts to urge the Israelis to be as precise and careful as possible, we can still continue to urge Israel to be more careful and more precise. The need for the Israeli Defense Forces to act with precision. We continue to work with the Israelis to make sure that they are as precise as they can be.
See, they're not listening. Have you tried synonyms for precision?
We continue to stress to our Israeli counterparts that they be as discriminate and careful in their targeting as possible. Be as cautious and deliberate and as careful as they can. To be more careful and more deliberate. Be very deliberate. In the most discreet, deliberate, careful, cautious way possible. The utmost care. And a special burden to be mindful.
To be mindful? What is this, hot yoga? We just, you know, we've seen the bombing and we are urging Netanyahu to be present. What the f*** are we doing here? The subtext of all this is America knows this is wrong, but it apparently doesn't seem to have the courage to say it in a straightforward manner. America and Israel both know that you cannot bomb your way into safety. We learned that lesson in Iraq and Afghanistan. They learned it in southern Lebanon. They laid siege there, occupied the southern area for 20 years. All it did was birth and strengthen Hezbollah. And they're about to do it all over again, and we are letting them. Real friends take the f***ing keys, because friends don't let friends bomb that much. And after this recent week, with so much horror, perhaps America finally finds the need for a new approach with Israel, with more justice and less cruelty.
The U.S. and Israel are closing in on what would be their largest weapons deal since the war in Gaza began.
Well, I don't know about you, but if that's true, I find it concerning.
So what's going on with President Biden? Recently, there was a fundraiser in New York. That fundraiser had former Presidents Obama, former President Clinton, and Joe Biden there. They raised about $26 million for the Democrats. It was disrupted several times by pro-Palestine protesters. But during his talk there, he said Israel's very existence is at stake. And I pay a lot of attention to President Biden's comments. And it wasn't until a meeting with the King of Jordan here in Washington, D.C., King Abdullah, that Joe Biden ever talked at length about Palestinian victims. But here he's talking about Israel, a superpower, and wondering about its very existence. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's hard to psychoanalyze Joe Biden. I mean, it's worth noting that Israel's existence is not at stake. It's incredibly powerful. October 7th was traumatic because Israelis didn't think that Hamas had the capacity even to breach its border, and clearly did, you know, enormous damage. But it was, you know, one day's worth of damage. It never threatened the Israeli state. But I think with Biden, there are two things. One is personal. I think he very much identifies with Israel. He still thinks of Israel from the early days. You know, this is where his age shows, you know, when Israel was really David against the Goliath of the combined Arab nations. And that's just not the current situation of the superpower Israel that continues, you know, for decades to occupy Palestinian territory. But, you know, I think there also has been a political calculation on Biden's part You know, he's always been focused on the movable middle, the handful of independents that will likely decide November's presidential election. And I think he kind of took for granted his base, you know, the progressive side of the Democratic Party, figuring, you know, they're not going to vote for Trump. I don't have to worry about them. I'm just going to focus on the movable middle. And what he clearly didn't count on, and I think the Michigan primary, the uncommitted vote there demonstrates this, is that, you know, some progressive Democrats are just so upset by Biden's green lighting of Netanyahu's killing and starvation in Gaza, that they may just abstain. You know, they're not going to vote for Trump, but they may just not vote, which is an effective vote for Trump. And so, you know, Biden is beginning to focus on that more. I think that's why he allowed the UN Security Council resolution to pass earlier this week. But he then, you know, undercut himself and you know, immediately his ambassador at the UN, the White House spokesperson said, oh, this is a non-binding resolution. Now, that's legally untrue. But the real point is political. He's signaling immediately to Netanyahu, don't worry about this. You know, we had to do this for political reasons, but keep doing what you're doing. And you know, that's utterly cynical. I think he hoped that, you know, that his constituents, the progressives, wouldn't really notice this technicality about whether a Security Council resolution is binding or not. They would just focus on the resolution. But people are not that stupid. They see that, you know, this is just, you know, virtue signaling. But in fact, the reality is Biden is still greenlighting and worse, really aiding and abetting these war crimes by continuing to provide the military aid and the arms sales.
In one sense, the question I have is whether or not America will have standing in the future to weigh in on human rights, to weigh in on values, to look at China and Xinjiang, look at various abuses in it, or is it in its apparent complicity with some of the arrangements now in this Israel clients in Gaza, has it lost standing to be a human rights commentator versus other nations in the future?
Well, I think, you know, frankly, even before October 7th, Biden's human rights policy was just filled with exceptions. And that is because even though, you know, early in his term, he said, I'm going to be guided by human rights and democratic principles. In fact, you know, for the last year, year and a half or more, he's been focused foremost on building global coalitions against China and Russia. And in that process, he's been willing to just close his eyes to terrible atrocities. So, you know, he you know, embraces the Saudi crown prince, even though, you know, he's utterly ruthless at home. He embraces Egypt President Sisi, even though he's presiding over the most repressive state in Egypt's modern history. He embraces Modi, you know, even though he's shutting down democracy in India. And so, you know, we've already seen elements of this. Now, I think that, you know, if you kind of take a Kissingerian realist approach, you know, one possible way to get through to Biden is that if he continues, which I think he does, to care about the competition with China and Russia, if he continues to care about Ukraine, he is hurting himself by this unequivocal embrace of Israel as it pummels Gaza. Because, you know, governments of the global South that he needs for things like United Nations votes or to enforce sanctions, they're saying, I want nothing to do with this. And if this has nothing to do with values, nothing to do with principles, if it's just a geopolitical competition, I'm going to sit this one out. You know, why is it so important to defend Ukraine if, you know, the principles that are at stake there, you're just jettisoning them when it comes to Gaza? And so I think that there is a, you know, a realist argument for why these values matter, because, you know, the nations of the world are not dumb. They see through this hypocrisy. And the lack of any principle, any even adherence to the so-called rule-based order when it comes to Israel is going to harm U.S. credibility on other things that Washington cares about.
Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese, recently told the U.N. Human Rights Council that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel is committing genocide with intent. Very, very powerful statement from her. And there was a remarkable statement from the State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller. Let's listen to it.
We have for a longstanding period of time opposed the mandate of this special rapporteur, which we believe is not productive. And when it comes to the individual who holds that position, I can't help but note a history of anti-Semitic comments that she has made. But with respect to the report itself, we have made clear that we believe that allegations of genocide are unfounded. But at the same time, We have are deeply concerned by the number of civilian casualties in Gaza, and that's why we have pressed the government of Israel on multiple occasions to do everything it can to minimize those civilian casualties.
Kenneth, I would love to hear your reactions to Matthew Miller's statement and your view in this kind of tension over classifying what we're seeing unfold on our TV screens as genocide or not.
Well, I think this is classic Biden administration double talk. You know, on the one hand, they say, oh, we're concerned about civilian casualties. On the other hand, they try to undercut any serious pressure on Israel to stop. And the special rapporteur's statement is just the latest example of this. Now, you know, there's a big debate about, you know, is this genocide or not? I should say first that I think this is a bit of a sideshow because while, you know, genocide is a horrible concept, it's a terrible crime. You know, many people think of it as the worst crime, but war crimes are horrible. Crimes against humanity are horrible. And there, it's pretty clear those are taking place.
The question is, why even bother with the performative outrage that Bassem Youssef is talking about if the Biden administration doesn't actually believe what they say? And the answer is, this is an election year, and the feigned concern is all an attempt to placate voters who are angry with the Biden administration's complicity in genocide. Democrats think that window dressing and tonal shifts are sufficient when that's no longer the case. It worked before, but it's not going to work anymore. And it's led to this disconnect between Democrats and their own base, where they don't understand why voters are still outraged over this issue since they've responded to their concerns by saying they're also concerned. For example, let's go back to Nancy Pelosi and listen to her defense of Joe Biden.
The president has been advocating for humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians. The Republicans in the House of Representatives have held it up. And yet, they hear these people go out there and say, oh, genocide, Joe, all that, not to repeat what they said, but nonetheless, he's the one who's been advocating for it.
That clip is so insightful because it demonstrates how Democrats just don't get it. It's not clicking for them, right? Voters want the genocide to end. You are not going to satisfy voters with your advocacy for certain things. So long as you are in a position of power and you assist Israel with their genocide, your advocacy means shit. We are past the days where you can dupe voters into thinking that you're listening by saying the right thing. They want action. And the Democratic Party's unwillingness to change has jeopardized their chances of winning in November. For example, CNN actually spoke to a couple of first and second time voters who previously backed Biden in 2020, but now they're not going to vote for Biden because he's not listening to them. And their demands are pretty clear.
If I were to vote tomorrow, I wouldn't vote. Period. Ideally, I would like to vote third party.
I'll vote for an independent candidate.
I'm considering either voting for Claudia De La Cruz or Cornel West at this point. If there is no substantive policy change when it comes to the genocide in Gaza, then there's not really a discussion for me.
When we met at this barbecue restaurant in Atlanta, all four told me they were raised and originally registered as Democrats. But this year, the president's handling of the Israel-Gaza war has turned them away.
I think what Biden has done in aiding and abetting a genocide is just something I cannot stand for.
You're willing to withhold your vote in the presidential election unless there is a ceasefire.
Yes.
And it's implemented.
Yes.
Not voting could mean Donald Trump gets into office. Do you think he'll be better on Gaza?
Trump would probably say, flatten Gaza and make it into a golf course. I have absolutely no faith in him.
Would you not say that also the people who are not voting for one of the two people who are the likely people to really be in this race have a role to play in kind of giving the race to Donald Trump in a state like Georgia where it's going to be like razor thin?
Yeah, no, I'll do you one better, actually. I think that just means that's why the Democrats should listen. We are holding their election in the palm of our hands, and they're not listening.
We're tired of just hearing him say these things, these empty promises. We have no trust in Joe Biden.
What could President Biden do to change your mind as far as how you'll vote in November?
Call for a permanent ceasefire and actually implement it. I would like us to stop giving aid to Israel.
If he doesn't get elected, that is his fault. That's not our fault. That's not the black voters here. That's not X, Y, and Z. No, it's on him.
Exactly. You are not going to bullshit these voters. They're telling you what they want and you're not doing it. You're not listening to them. And Democrats just can't comprehend how their flowery rhetoric isn't sufficient any longer. Like, they're like, we said what you wanted us to say. Why aren't you taking yes for an answer? It's because they're demanding actual policy concessions. They don't want more feigned concern or calls for Israel to do X, Y, or Z. They want the bloodshed to stop. These voters are tapped in, and they know bullshit when they see it. And Biden has the power to end this by cutting off weapons to Israel. That's what these voters want, and they know that Biden can do that, but he's choosing to allow this to continue. Again, this is what former presidents have done. Ronald Reagan called up a former Israeli prime minister and demanded that they end their actions in Lebanon, and they did it 20 minutes later. Why? Because he threatened to cut off munitions to them. Biden can do what Reagan did, but he's chosen to not do that. He is continuing to sell them weapons. And that's just not acceptable. Anything short of stopping the sale of weapons to Israel and being complicit directly with their genocide, that is going to lose him votes. They're not going to vote for Trump, as they stated. They're either going to stay home or vote third party. And even though that is a small sample size that we saw in that clip, these voters are echoing what others have already said. Stop supporting genocide or you lose our votes. It's not like the Democrats haven't gotten the message because they're being protested at every fucking event. But again, the problem is that they're choosing to not listen and they think that the rhetoric is enough when it's not.
Lawyers representing Germany at the International Court of Justice delivered their concluding remarks at The Hague today in a case brought by Nicaragua, which has accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide in Gaza by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Nicaragua has asked the UN's top court for emergency measures, ordering the German government to halt its support to Israel. Germany is Israel's second largest arms supplier after the U.S. In 2023, Germany approved arms exports to Israel valued at over $353 million, roughly 10 times the sum approved the previous year. For more, we're joined by Kenneth Roth, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as the executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's joining us now in New York. Can you explain why Nicaragua is simply taking on Germany and the significance of this case, another case being brought to the UN's top court?
Obviously, the United States would have been the ideal target. The U.S. is the principal armor of the Israeli military. But the U.S. Has a much more limited acceptance of the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. It basically has to consent to every suit, and it was not going to consent to this suit. Germany is a much more open-ended acceptance of the jurisdiction. So Germany being the second largest armor of the Israeli military, it was the target. Now, in terms of the significance, the court has already found that this is a plausible case of genocide. And Nicaragua is saying, Germany, you are arming potential genocide. They also have added that Germany is arming actual war crimes, violations of international humanitarian law, which it clearly is. Now, there is a precedent for this. If you remember back to Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, he was convicted of aiding and abetting war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone and is actually currently serving a 50-year prison term in Britain for that crime. So the International Court of Justice is a civil court. It's not a criminal court. But Nicaragua is basically pursuing the same theory, saying, you know, this is at least war crimes. It's plausible genocide. You're arming it. That's aiding and abetting. You should stop. That's the essence of the case.
I wanted to ask you, Kenneth, there were 40 Democratic members of Congress, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who have written to President Biden urging him to halt new arms transfers to Israel in the wake of the killing of the World Central Kitchen aid workers. What's your sense of the prospects for possibly halting or at least significantly reducing U.S. arms shipments to Israel?
Well, you know, one, that has been the line that Joe Biden has been unwilling to cross. He has spoken at this point quite eloquently, pushing Israel to stop bombing civilians, to allow more food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But these, from Netanyahu's perspective, are just empty words because Joe Biden never backs them up with consequences. And the obvious consequence, the obvious huge leverage that the U.S. government has is the $3.8 billion in annual military aid it gives Israel and the regular shipment of arms, you know, almost every week in the course of this conflict. And Biden has not been willing to explicitly condition those, that aid, those arms sales on ending the bombing and starving of Palestinian civilians. Now, we heard last week that in the private phone call with Netanyahu, Biden suggested that at some point in the future, this might be conditioned, you know, that U.S. relations will depend on how Israel responds. But it was all very vague. And of course, Netanyahu responded with equal vagueness. He says, okay, at some point, I'll open up the new crossing into northern Gaza to allow more food aid in. But that'll take a few weeks. And I'm not saying anything about whether I'll impose the same kind of obstructions in the north as I've imposed in the south. And I won't say anything about, you know, Israel's shooting at Palestinian police officers so that there's chaos when you try to distribute the food. You know, none of that is on the table. So in essence, Biden is not using this huge leverage, despite the pleas of an increasing number of lawmakers in Washington, you know, despite rapidly changing U.S. opinion polls saying Americans are tired of the U.S. actively supporting these war crimes, this plausible genocide in Gaza.
Why is he doing this? I mean, it is amazing to see the split in the Democratic establishment. I'm not just talking about the protesters on the streets who definitely are driving this split. But, you know, you have now Senator Warren of Massachusetts saying she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. You have Christopher Coons, who I consider a Biden whisperer, who is now talking about halting weapons sales to Israel. But you have Biden resisting, though he has talked about a ceasefire. Why is this so difficult for him? What do you think it would take, especially now that you have Netanyahu saying that he set the date certain for invasion of Rafah?
He just won't tell us what that date is. Yes. Amy, that's the big psychoanalytic question, and we just don't know. I mean, part of it, I think, is that Joe Biden, you know, who is an older man, as we know, you know, thinks of Israel back in 1967. When it was the Davids surrounded by the Goliath of all the Arab states attacking Israel. He doesn't think of Israel today, the regional superpower, a nuclear-armed state, a state that has been occupying Palestinian territory for decades and is imposing apartheid. You know, that's just not in his mind. More to the point, he seems to be making a political calculation, and he's always, you know, been focused on the movable middle, the handful of independent voters who could go either way in the six swing states. And what he seems to be discounting is the progressives. And clearly the Michigan primary was a bit of a wake-up call. Suddenly the large number of uncommitted votes in a swing state. And so we've seen him being more attentive, but I think he still calculates that progressives have no place to go. They're not going to vote for Trump, and abstaining is effectively a vote for Trump. So when push comes to shove in November, they're going to have to hold their nose and vote for Biden. And that seems to be what is pushing him at this stage.
As I think about it, and tell me if you think I'm wrong here, I think about five threads kind of running through this election. And I'm curious if that's what you see showing up in your focus groups and in the polling. And I kind of think of like three issues, you know, abortion, the genocide in Gaza, and immigration / the border. And then kind of overlaid over all of that, you've got Biden's age, and then you've got just Trump as a phenomenon and what people think of him and just Trumpism and MAGAism. Is that right? You know, I have spent so much time the last 5 months reporting on what's going on in Gaza. I wonder sometimes if I'm in something of a bubble, like a bubble of people who care about this ongoing genocide, because I can't tell if I walk outside of it, if how much it's kind of resonating with a typical voter. So first of all, I'm curious, like, how much of a actually caring about this genocide bubble am I in? How much do you see it among the voting public?
It is a bit of a bubble. You're right to sort of ask that question in terms of for whom is this not meaningful, I would say, but salient, by which I mean not that people don't feel that this is, to use, you know, the lightest possible term, like distasteful, horrific, horrible, not okay, all those things, but rather whether or not it rises to the level of their kind of daily thought patterns, their electoral calculus, et cetera. So that's what I mean by saliency. That is a bit of a bubble. You are sort of existing among outliers if we're just looking at kind of statistics. We even purposely did focus groups in Dearborn, Michigan among young disaffected voters of color because we wanted to sort of like go into where we thought the bubble would be most highly concentrated because we wanted precisely to look at that. I mean, a focus group is an idiosyncratic thing and it's anecdotal, especially when I'm talking about that one single focus group. We were surprised to not get more of that, you know, coming at us initially in terms of people volunteering that as being core to their calculus. Definitely aware of it, but there's a difference between aware and core to the calculus. I think the thing to say about the bubble that is really important is that we tend to forget, or political campaigns to their peril tend to forget, that it's not just about how many people, it's about which people this upsets. And why I say that is because the people that it upsets, and rightly so, are in many places like Michigan, an important part of the choir. They are, if you will, the like lead tenor, lead alto, etc. And so if the people that you rely upon to knock on doors, to drive voters out, to kind of speak about this, to get their friends and family to be paying attention to this election and to be wanting to participate, even if it's relatively few in numbers, it's not just the how many, it's the who. And that's where it does matter as a political calculus, not to mention that it matters just as a moral question, which I would argue is more important.
Yes. And I want to underline that this is ultimately first and foremost and last a moral question. But here we're talking about the election. And so we'll just have to muscle through the discomfort associated with talking about it in those terms. But I think you're right in my experience that the types of people who are going to go out and vote uncommitted or uninstructed are also the types of people who in their friend group are the ones, and then in their family are the ones that people are going to for advice. Now, that might be more relevant on a congressional or senatorial level than on a presidential level, where everybody kind of has their own opinion of Trump and Biden. But it does seem like those are your workers. Those are your messengers. If the messengers aren't just not unwilling to canvass, but actively hostile, you know, to you, that's a significant problem. This week in Wisconsin, roughly 50,000 people voted uninstructed, you know, with a very tiny budget for a campaign, one that's not intuitive at all, yet still managed to get, what, 1.5 times the number, the margin between Biden and Trump in 2020. I think Biden won it by about 20,000 votes. So to see 50,000 Democrats voting uninstructed does seem concerning. But what is your sense of what the Democratic Party plan is for this? It doesn't seem like any policy change is on the horizon. And absent that, I can't imagine that there's any messaging has its limits, I would imagine.
True story. Messaging does have its limits. You cannot solve a policy problem with a message. So I'm going to answer in two ways. The first is, what do I think from my own perch is their plan? And then what do I think as a messaging answer as opposed to a policy answer? Because I'm in full agreement. The answer is that the policy has to change. That's the answer, period, the end. I think that probably their calculus is that one of two or both things will happen. And to be honest, I certainly hope for moral reasons that there is a leadership spill within Israel. It's poised to happen. I don't know how closely you observe politics happening there. I'm actually Israeli. There are growing demonstrations. Over last weekend, there were the largest demonstrations, I believe, to date, and it was a merging of demonstration movement that's been led by a group called Omdim Biyachad, Standing Together, which is co-led by Palestinians and Jews.
Oh yeah, I saw the Standing Together duo when they came to DC, actually. Yeah, really, really interesting organization.
Yeah, I am not objective because they are friends, so...
Oh, actually, I noticed some of your rhetoric on their website now that I think about it. Some of your messaging.
Oh,
yes. Like you're
that's very
the kind
kind
of a not approach to they're highlighting our differences so that they can enrich themselves and dominate.
Yeah, basically ascribing motivation to the villains in order to explain how they use this divide and conquer strategy that's actually bad for all of us. Yes, they're great. So... big protests and emerging of ceasefire protests within Israel with the hostage families very much in the lead, as they've always been, and rightly so, and protests to demand that Netanyahu step down or that there be a sort of reconfiguration of what we already know to be a very precarious coalition. I know this is hard for a lot of American listeners to understand because we don't have a parliamentary system. And so if you're not used to it, it sort of seems... like gobbledygook, but there can be leadership change without an election within a parliamentary system. So I think that part of the hope, and like I said, my very naked hope is that Netanyahu be gone for reasons that I think would just be beneficial to humanity, not to the US election. And that change and a change in policy, because I think the person poised to kind of lead a new coalition. I'm not saying he's a shining star of humanity, but, you know, he is much, much better than Netanyahu, which is a low bar, that there will just be a change within Israel and that will sort of reflect and it will help the situation and so on. So that is like perhaps calculation number one. I think calculation number two is something that you've already intuited, which is that November is a long way away. Most people are not paying attention to politics, and that is actually the bigger divide than even partisanship that I've spoken about before. It's really a divide between people who are sort of following all the machinations and the news and what's going on, and people who are like, huh, there's election in November. And believe it or not, there are many people who are, huh, there's an election in November. I know if you're listening to this podcast, that sounds like I made that up, but trust, that's most people. So I think that the calculation is probably that something will change internally with time in the region, and this just isn't going to be what people are focused on.
When you're looking at United States diplomacy and standing in the world, what does this support for Israel do for American credibility in the region and internationally, just more broadly? And if you could compare that to the degradation of international standing that the United States saw happen to it in the wake of the Iraq War, what are your observations there about U.S. standing in the Middle East from a diplomatic perspective?
I think you're very right to highlight the effects of the Iraq War and, you know, the illegal means that the U.S., that the, you know, Bush administration used to invade Iraq. I do think that this administration had tried to really reestablish some of like I was saying, America's participation in international institutions. I think the many people, especially within the State Department, saw U.S. support for Ukraine as a means to sort of reestablish American credibility, standing up for a democracy, you know, a civilian population undergoing an illegal invasion and assault. I think the Ukraine-Gaza juxtaposition just really highlights the hypocrisy here. And I think that has been that was something that came up frequently with State Department colleagues, that when Ukraine happened, they talked about how they were encouraged to support Ukraine, even if they weren't working on Ukraine, just, you know, wear a Ukraine flag pin or like put up a poster or something. Whereas with Gaza, the message people were getting was, this isn't your area. You don't work on this. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. And just, you know, I think the American self-image was so ready to grab onto this support for Ukraine as a means of reestablishing America's self-respect in kind of the aftermath of the war on terror. And I think that the ongoing support for Israel has just really reaffirmed the extent to which that self-image is false. And although I personally would really welcome if the U.S. government were to try to adopt policies that did affirm human rights and all of these ideas about American exceptionalism and standing up for the rule of law and the world, you know, the liberal international order. But in general, we don't see that happening. And I do think it has been a huge blow to American credibility. You know, it's made a mockery of the UN, the UN Security Council. You know, the U.S. abstained on that vote, but then immediately came out and said it was a non-binding resolution.
Which is a lie, because UN Security Council resolutions by definition are supposed to be binding.
Exactly. This was a question I asked. You know, the State Department has held open fora about Gaza, which I really welcome that they were, you know, inviting people to speak about this. Many, many people were concerned and devastated. And continue to be. But this was a question I asked of a senior official, which was, it seems that this policy, this U.S. support for Israel is being treated as more important than the question of China, which this administration likes to talk about, the question of Ukraine, which, again, big priority, Russia, climate change, human rights, participation in international institutions, you know, a foreign policy for the middle class, whatever that's supposed to mean. Just all of these priorities the administration campaigned on and claimed to be governing in the name of, or you know, making decisions to support. Why is the U.S.-Israel relationship seen as more important than all of these other questions, many of which are existential? I would, you know, climate change, you know, a great power war with China. I mean, that would be, you know, it could be nuclear annihilation. I mean, you know, like, these are huge issues. And yet the ongoing support for this far right wing government in Israel, for some reason, is seen as more important. And that, you know, the official didn't have a good answer to that question. I still don't have a good answer.
Can you give us a sense of how unique the relationship is within, you know, diplomatic channels between the United States and Israel, how other relationships, maybe within the purview of your office or your colleagues, might be treated within the normal kind of day-to-day work of the State Department versus the very top-down, and let's be clear, this is from Biden himself. This is clearly ideological for him, as he's a Zionist and he has said so. How unique that is from the other work of the State Department and how that kind of feels within the work in the State Department.
Certainly. That's a good question. I think that, you know, so like with my office, which focuses, or my former office focuses on human rights, it's very easy to criticize Iran or Syria, rightly. These are governments that engage in horrific human rights violations. But so does Saudi Arabia, and so does Israel. So does the UAE. So, and yet those countries are routinely not called out for their human rights violations. In terms of your question of the uniqueness of Israel, I would, you know, my previous work at Quincy focused primarily, a lot of it focused on the Saudi war on Yemen. And in particular, things like the U.S. saying they were going to cut off offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia, which initially they sort of did. It remains the official policy.
We talked about this, actually, I'm remembering now, because offensive weapons were categorized in this very broad sense, and, you know, or offensive weapons was quite specific, and defensive could mean anything, basically.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
I'm remembering now. Yeah.
So just to highlight there that even though the U.S.-Saudi relationship is extremely important in terms of, you know, the way it has been understood for decades, but Biden still was willing to take that step of cutting off offensive weapons as wobbly, you know, although there were some wiggle room there. They still publicly took this step, and, you know, and until the notorious fist bump with MBS, you know, initially Biden was maintaining a degree of distance from the Saudi throne, which was new. That was that is not what we've seen with Israel. There have been no willingness to cut off weapons. Even when Netanyahu, you know, canceled the visit to just come ask for more weapons, and now he's rescheduling the visit to talk about the impending invasion of Rafah, which is going to be, as I mentioned in the op-ed, I can't even talk about it. Biden isn't doing anything different. He's just continuing to support what this government is doing. I think what I'm also really concerned about is the war expanding. And sorry.
It's okay. I've cried a million times on the show about this. So yeah, it's good to have another soft-hearted woman around to cry with me.
Yeah. I really worry about the U.S. getting dragged into another war in the Middle East. I know many, you know, the majority of Americans, when you poll them, are really tired of, you know, sending young people to go die in the Middle East. And I think that this administration is not doing enough or really much of anything significant to insist to Israel that if Bibi invades Lebanon, the U.S. is not going to back him up. I think, in contrast, Bibi knows the U.S. would back him up if he did that, and that's why he's preparing to do so.
The bombing of the Iranian embassy in Syria overnight, yesterday, that is also a major escalation that I'd imagine is extremely concerning to you.
Absolutely. And it's because Netanyahu's political interests are best served by keeping all the violence going as long as possible. I mean, I feel like there's been insufficient attention to the fact that that the Israeli hostages are sort of held up as like, well, Hamas just has to get back the hostages, which they do. But Bibi's not interested in that, because then he wouldn't be able to continue to justify all this violence. I mean, if that was actually his primary goal, that could have happened months ago. I mean, that could have happened within the first few weeks. But that's not his goal. And I think, you know, the families of the hostages who are just desperate to get their family members back are not, you know, they're protesting. There have been huge protests in Israel against the fact that the government of Israel is prioritizing bombing and starving the people of Gaza, and now likely expanding this war into a regional, what could become a nuclear conflagration. And yet criticism of Israel continues to be tarred as anti-Semitic when, you know, this government is not listening to their own people. I don't understand why this continues to be the policy that the U.S. government just continues to support. You know, there are all these questions about American credibility and, you know, other governments crossing red lines and, you know, like, this is going to send a signal that China can invade Taiwan. There's all this like analysis about how the U.S. has to stand firm on what it says it's committed to, what the red lines are. And that hasn't And yet, you know, Bibi keeps crossing all of these red lines. And, you know, where are all those people shouting about, you know, the U.S. has to, like, maintain credibility on these issues?
It's maddening.
We've just heard clips today, starting with The Daily Show interrogating the United States' support of Israel. Al Jazeera English looked at how supporting Israel hurts the U.S. on other foreign policy matters. The Humanist Report examined the perspective of voters willing to withhold their votes from Biden based on his support of Israel. Democracy Now! Looked at the disconnect between Biden's words and the lack of actions to back them up. Deconstructed focused on the political danger of alienating your most influential supporters. And the Majority Report discussed the hit to American credibility our support of Israel brings. That's what everybody heard, but members also heard bonus clips from Doomed, understanding Biden as most likely the last Democratic president to steadfastly support Israel. And Democracy Now!, which spoke with some of the protesters bird-dogging Joe Biden. To hear that and have all of our bonus content delivered seamlessly to the new members-only podcast feed that you'll receive, sign up to support the show at bestofleft.com/support, or shoot me an email requesting a financial hardship membership, because we don't let a lack of funds stand in the way of hearing more information. Now to wrap up, I have a few thoughts. First, I think it's worth taking a look back to compare a bit of what's been said and some of what's been done by Israel in the last 6 months, starting immediately after the horrific war crime attack by Hamas on October 7th, representatives of Israel began describing the reaction that would be coming, including the war crimes they intended to commit. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, apologies for the mispronunciation, on October 9th said, quote, "We are imposing a complete siege on Gaza. There will be no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything will be closed. We are fighting human animals, and we are acting accordingly," end quote. And since then, headlines like these have been rolling out. In December, from Human Rights Watch, Israel: starvation used as weapon of war in Gaza. In January, from Time, how experts believe Israel utilizes starvation in Gaza. In March, from the New York Times, UN says Israel may be restricting Gaza aid as a war tactic. So, what we know for sure, whether it is the official policy of Israel to use starvation as a weapon of war or not, there are definitely people in the Israeli government who want to do that. And the results in the real world look very much like one would expect if a policy like that were being carried out. And in conversations about Israel, there's often the accusation that Israel is being unfairly singled out for condemnation, held to a higher standard, it's often said, etc. My first piece of advice would be for Israel to stop comparing themselves to such a low standard. It's the same rhetorical trick played by right-wing people looking for excuses to act badly everywhere. Anti-gay conservatives in the U.S. like to downplay the need for LGBTQ-friendly policies because we're already better than other countries where people are killed by the government for being gay as a matter of policy. You know, not as bad as murderous human rights abusers has a real ring of pride to it, as does we can commit war crimes because they did it first. A sentiment recognizable to anyone who's met a child who has not yet reached the age of reason. So unsurprisingly, arguments like that aren't being received well by the majority of rational people in the world, which is why it's so predictable that the incredibly vast majority of the world has now turned against Israel, at least in terms of their prosecution of their assault on Gaza. And as a U.S. State Department memo obtained by NPR recently warned, Israelis are, quote, facing major, possibly generational damage to their reputation as a result of its military conduct in Gaza. And There's a lot to be said about explanations, not excuses, but explanations of Israel's actions. We just recorded a whole bonus show for members. It's bonus episode number 300 that'll be coming out soon, discussing some of the extreme far right in Israel and the impact of the history of discrimination and attempted extermination the Jews have faced. But one factor we didn't mention, which is much more immediate than the historical context of the conflict, is the right-wing grip on the media in Israel. This is just real quick, this headline from The Guardian. The far-right infiltration of Israel's media is blinding the public to the truth about Gaza. Proponents of the settler movement, backed by Netanyahu, are ruling the airwaves and skewing coverage of the conflict. So for Israel, it goes beyond the history and the particularly inflamed anger and hurt in the wake of October 7th. It's also an inability to see the actions of their government clearly, and with a government that seems intent on committing war crimes and international standing plummeting, it's possible that not enough of the population will get a clear view of what's going on before it's too late, and that reputation is irretrievable. And so, if your interest is in the well-being and safety of Jews around the world, and if you are concerned, as I am, about the rise in overt and vocal anti-Semitism in the past 6 months, I think the better route is to do away with any of those weak arguments trying to defend or excuse away Israeli actions in Gaza, like the empty and meaningless platitude, well, they do have the right to defend themselves. Explain the history and context, yes, but clarify that it's not all Israelis, much less all Jews around the world, who support the extremist government of Israel and condemn the actions that must be condemned unreservedly. That is going to be it for today. As always, keep the comments coming in. I would love to hear your thoughts or questions about this or anything else. You can leave us a voicemail or send us a text at 202-999-3991 or simply email me to j@bestofleft.com. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Dion Clark and Aaron Clayton for their research work for the show and participation in our bonus episodes. Thanks to our transcriptionist quartet, Ken, Brian, Ben, and Andrew for their volunteer work helping put our transcripts together. Thanks to Amanda Hoffman for all of her work behind the scenes and her bonus show co-hosting. And thanks to those who already support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships. You can join them by signing up today at bestoftheleft.com/support through our Patreon page or from right inside the Apple Podcasts app. Membership is how you get instant access to our incredibly good and often funny bonus episodes, in addition to there being extra content, no ads, and chapter markers in all of our regular episodes, all through your regular podcast player. You'll find that link in the show notes, along with a link to join our Discord community, where you can also continue the discussion. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com.